Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Gretchen Goldman of the Union of Concerned Scientists, who explains why she believes the Trump administration ban on EPA-funded scientists serving on agency advisory boards puts Americans at risk. Pia Gallegos, longtime civil rights attorney and co-author of the new report, Autopsy, the Democratic Party in Crisis, summarizes the report's conclusions and recommendations. And homeless activist Quentin Staggers, who talks about the lack of services and harassment suffered by homeless people as he addressed the recent Housing Not Jails march in New Haven, Connecticut. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Russian President Vladimir Putin and Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei recast their strategic alliance, including support for the International Iran Nuclear Agreement, during a recent summit meeting in Tehran. Russia and Iran are allies in supporting Bashar al-Assad's regime in Syria and have signed new cooperation agreements. It was another step forward for Putin's drive to boost Russia's influence in the Middle East. Russian military aid has helped turn the tide in favor of Assad and Syria's civil war. In recent days, Syrian soldiers, with the support of Russian airstrikes and Shia militias, drove ISIS insurgents out of the city of Deir ez-Zor in eastern Syria. In mid-October, President Trump decertified the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement, and the U.S. Congress now has 60 days to debate the imposition of new sanctions, which, if passed, would terminate the deal. Observers say Russia is stepping in to fill a void left by the Trump administration's erratic and largely hands-off policies in the region. Pre-trial hearings before the U.S. military commission trying the alleged mastermind of the terrorist attack on the USS Cole in 2000 erupted in chaos as Air Force Colonel and Judge Vance Spath imposed a 21-day confinement against the military commission's chief defense counsel, Marine Brigadier General John Baker. General Baker had released the defense team representing the accused, Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri, over a still-secret dispute over attorney-client privilege. Spath had ordered the defense team to represent Nashiri through a video link, but the defense lawyers refused, stating they believe the government may be eavesdropping on attorney-client communications. Lawyers for Baker filed a habeas corpus petition accusing the military judge of violating his due process rights. Baker was briefly under house arrest at his residence on the Guantanamo Bay Navy base, but was later released by Pentagon officials. According to the Miami Herald, a trio of civilian lawyers quit the Cole case in mid-October. This left Nashiri without a lawyer with death penalty experience, a violation of the act which established the military commission. The case against Nashiri is stuck in pretrial hearings over disputes regarding classified evidence and the need for a court-ordered MRI to see if the defendant suffered any brain damage during 4 years of secret CIA detention. Capital defense lawyer Rick Kamen, who has represented Nashiri for 10 years, says he resigned over what he calls government misconduct, asserting that the procedures are a facade of justice to keep the military commissions running. In Texas, the number of deaths among young African-American mothers is rising. Nationally, 700 women a year die and 60,000 almost lose their lives from complications related to pregnancy and childbirth. Despite broad gains in American medicine, women die in childbirth at a much higher rate than in other developed nations. Maternal death rates in the U.S. have more than doubled between 1987 and 2013. According to data from the Texas Department of Health, African American women accounted for 29% of pregnancy-related deaths, despite having only 11% of births in the Lone Star State. The Los Angeles Times reports that Texas currently has the highest uninsured population in the U.S. The Republican-led state government has cut women's health care programs, including screenings for diabetes, hypertension, and cervical cancer, which, if left untreated, could play a role in maternal deaths. Some studies have shown that chronic stress triggered by racism and discrimination can lead to premature deaths, low birth weights, and life-threatening complications. Moreover, many African American women complain they are routinely rushed through the medical screening process, and clinicians often downplay described symptoms. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
In another in a long line of controversial edicts issued by the Trump administration's Environmental Protection Agency Administrator, Scott Pruitt, new rules were announced on October 31st, which bars scientists and others who receive EPA grant funding from serving on the agency's science advisory boards. The action will purge a large number of scientists who are well-known authorities in the fields of ecology, human biology, toxicology, in epidemiology. Pruitt was quoted as saying the new policy was designed to prevent a conflict of interest. However, the EPA administrator, who is widely expected to appoint representatives of industries that the EPA regulates to sit on science advisory panels, has not issued any new policies to prevent commonplace conflicts of interest related to regulatory law, which often cut into corporate profits. Environmentalists, congressional Democrats, and scientific organizations have all condemned Pruitt's purge, asserting that the ban prevents the nation's top scientific experts from advising the EPA while strengthening the influence of industry representatives with clear ethical challenges. Lawsuits are likely. Your reporter spoke with Gretchen Goldman, research director with the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Here she explains why her group believes Scott Pruitt's directive undermines independent science and puts Americans at risk.
Advisory committees are bodies of external scientists, so scientists from outside the government. A lot of them come from academia and other places where they're doing scientific work, and they volunteer that expertise and their time to help inform the U.S. government on a variety of issues. And this happens across federal agencies. At the EPA, science advisors provide advice on everything from air pollution to water quality to chemical safety hazards. And so these advisory committees play a very crucial role in getting external science advice to the agency, and it gives them that extra power, and it allows the public to see if the agency is making science-based decisions, because we have this independent body that can, you know, help call them on anything that isn't scientific and really hold them to account. And so these advisory committees really operate separately, and that's worked very, very well for many years. And what we're seeing is Administrator Pruitt is starting to try to dismantle that process. And so by banning scientists that received grants from the EPA to do scientific research and further science in a particular field is really excluding scientists that are your best experts from being able to advise the agency. It's very, very strange. The best analogy that I came up with is that it's really like saying a teacher who last year received a teaching award doesn't get to serve on the PTA. You know, and I don't know why you would not want to give your best minds a seat at the table, but that's exactly what Administrator Pruitt is doing.
Would you be able to address for our audience the claim that's out there somewhere among the Trump appointees at the EPA, including Scott Pruitt, that there's the specter of conflict of interest for these scientists who receive EPA grants to fund their research?
Yeah, it's really turning the idea of conflict of interest on its head. You know, a typical EPA grant would go toward furthering scientific understanding on a certain topic. So I'm an air pollution scientist. So something that, you know, I might apply to get a grant for would be studying multi-pollutant interactions and their health effects. And then if I were to also serve on a committee, I might get asked something like whether or not the EPA was going in the right direction when it came to water quality testing. And so, you know, if I had this grant on air pollution, how does that even tell me how I'm supposed to provide advice on water quality, right? They're totally different realms. It's really apples and oranges here. Even if you wanted to try to come up with an answer on an advisory committee that you felt like the EPA wanted, you know, it's not even clear what that would be, you know? So I don't know. Have they just sort of created this argument and decided that independent scientists, particularly those from academic institutions, that they would be conflicted? But meanwhile, they've added to the committee many people from industry, so people with strong ties to industries that are affected by EPA regulation. And those people are unrestricted in that they're able to serve despite those very clear conflicts of interest. So they've really flipped this idea around and turned it on its head.
This is not an academic exercise here. What goes on at the EPA actually affects people's lives. What the EPA does or doesn't do can actually save lives or condemn people to lives of diseases which could have been prevented. From your perspective as a scientist yourself, what's at stake here in terms of lives, the lives of Americans out there?
That's right. There's a lot at stake. The EPA, people often think of it as being an environmentally focused agency, but its mission is actually about public health, too. And a lot of what the agency does now does protect people from issues. And the more that we defund the agency or remove scientists from the process or limit the resources that they have, the less they're going to be able to protect us from all of these hazards. And so it's everything from the air pollution that we talked about. It's also water quality and making sure that they're in charge of maintaining the Safe Drinking Water Act and implementing that. It's also chemical hazards, which is a whole other area of concern now, since many of the Trump administration appointees at the EPA on the chemical safety side have actually come directly from the chemical manufacturing industries. The air pollution doesn't care if you're a Democrat or a Republican or what state you live in, you know, it's going to affect us all. And so I think we need to be diligent in making sure that we can minimize what happens there and keep people protected.
That was Gretchen Goldman, Research Director with the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Learn more about opposition to the banning of EPA-funded scientists from serving on the agency's advisory boards by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As Donald Trump enters his 10th month in office, public opinion polls find he's the most unpopular president at this stage in his term than any other occupant of the Oval Office in modern American history. His actions at home and abroad have alarmed Democrats, Republicans, and independents. Apart from recent indictments by the Independent Counsel investigating charges of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, the president is seen to have triggered a number of ugly fights with Gold Star family members, NFL players, exacerbated tensions with nuclear North Korea, and praise white supremacists as very fine people. But as many U.S. voters remember the shock and dread they felt on Election Day 2016, when Donald Trump unexpectedly won the presidency, there are growing concerns that the Democratic Party has failed to learn the lessons of last year's election defeat. The Democratic National Committee chose not to do a public autopsy examining the reasons their party no longer has control of any branch of the federal government, only holds 16 of 50 governorships, and has lost 1,000 state legislative seats since 2009. Filling this void, a group of activists with a nonprofit, Action for a Progressive Future, wrote a 34-page report titled Autopsy, the Democratic Party in Crisis. The report focuses on some key factors that have contributed to the Democrats' recent string of defeats, including low voter turnout among the party's base. Your reporter spoke with Pia Gallegos, a longtime civil rights lawyer and New Mexico activist, who was one of the team of four authors of the autopsy. Here she summarizes the report's conclusions and recommendations.
The Democratic Party itself did not do a self-analysis or a critique regarding its failures of how and why it lost the presidential election in 2016. Oftentimes, a party does that when it loses a major election, and it didn't do that, and if it did it, it didn't publicize it. And so a group of us took it upon ourselves under the leadership of Norman Solomon to do this report. And so we looked at various factors that failed within the Democratic Party. And we looked at corporate power and the party, and we looked at race, and we looked at youth vote, and we looked at social movements, and we looked at democracy or the failure of democracy within the party and war in the party. And we divided the report into sections like that and showed how the Democratic Party has continuously, in all of these areas, failed to address the concerns of its constituencies.
Maybe you could talk about a little bit about what you see in terms of the leadership of the Democratic Party right now and following the election defeat.
Right. I'm sorry to say, you know, that there's really two wings to the Democratic Party, and we see this even with the head of the Democratic Party right now, Tom Perez. He's the head of the DNC, and he's just acted recently to purge the DNC of some of the most progressive members of the DNC, because he's allowed to appoint people and to depose people from their posts. And so he's brought in a whole bunch of political operatives and lobbyists, corporate lobbyists, as members of the DNC who will have superdelegate status, which means that they will be able to vote for a presidential candidate without regard to the pledged delegates that are required on every state level through the Electoral College. So as well, as flawed as the Electoral College is in not allowing a popular vote to determine who's going to be president, the Democratic Party has superimposed on top of that flawed scheme this idea of superdelegates, who are people who are not responsive to the vote at all, who have no obligation to vote the will of the people, but who can vote the will of their corporate sponsors. Perez gets to also nominate his own superdelegates, and he has chosen corporate operatives and corporate lobbyists. So the Democratic Party is so far away from the will of the people and the realities of poor people who are struggling and students who are burdened by thousands and tens of thousands of dollars of student debt. And so we do have a fractious Democratic Party here. But fortunately, you know, the people who are working, the foot soldiers of the Democratic Party, the ones who are working on the level of the neighborhoods, I mean, you know, we're the ones who are right now trying to get the elected Democrats to be accountable, to be held accountable to what it is our real needs on the level of neighborhoods and working class people.
A lot of pundits look at the Democratic Party these days and they see this ongoing conflict between the forces that supported Hillary Clinton and those that supported Senator Bernie Sanders. Are you concerned that this conflict, if it continues on within the party, will detract from any gains that the Democrats could make as a party in the upcoming critical 2018 election, given the stakes are so high with all the rollbacks of progressive policies with the Trump administration in the White House and Republicans controlling Congress?
It is absolutely essential for the Democrats to get elected to be taking care of the people of color and the youth vote and listening to their voices. And that's how we're going to bring them back. If we could pay attention to Black communities and the Native American communities and the Latino communities and get and bring them back to vote. That's how we're going to win elections here. And so we're doing the only thing that can be done to get the Democratic Party in power again, which is to go to those neglected communities. That's the only way we're going to win.
That was Pia Gallegos, a longtime civil rights lawyer and New Mexico activist, who was one of four authors of the report titled Autopsy, the Democratic Party in Crisis. Find a link to the report and related analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On November 1st, about 100 homeless people and their supporters marched through downtown New Haven, Connecticut, demanding housing and dignity. Although New Haven spends more money than other cities in Connecticut on programs for the homeless and states that its first priority is getting people into housing where they can deal with their other issues such as unemployment, addiction, and mental illness, some of those marching complained of being abused by the police. Others described dirty, overcrowded conditions in one of the city's main homeless shelters. Activists that day marched from a church that provides meals to City Hall and then to the state courthouse. Marchers stopped outside another church that's offering sanctuary to an undocumented immigrant before being welcomed by another congregation for a full-course dinner. Homeless activist Quentin Staggers, who organized the Housing Not Jails March in cooperation with the Connecticut Bail Fund, compiled a list of demands for the winner of New Haven's November 7th mayoral election. Those demands included decriminalizing activities such as loitering and sleeping in public spaces, expanding and improving the city's homelessness initiatives, and ending the tax-exempt status of Yale University property. During the march, several people addressed the crowd, including Staggers, who we hear in this segment, recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus.
You know, 60-something days ago, there was a lot of people being incarcerated, and a lot of people getting tickets out here in the New Haven Green. We began bailing those individuals out like myself in the community. We began building character for those like myself and that's homeless in the community. What I witnessed and what I've been just here as being homeless, several months ago, I read a newspaper and it said that the city had over 700 vacant properties and abandoned buildings. I then took that newspaper in my portfolio of 61 homeless individuals who were served certified and had certifications as roofers, plumbers, electricians, carpenters, framers, landscapers, you name it. Even though they were homeless, they were certified.
Yes, they were.
That then was brought to the mayor here, Tony Hart, who shot it down and said it was a liability issue. And said it was a liability issue. Well, okay, let Habitat for Humane do it then. And it was still taken off the table. But I then began to still go hard for those like myself and who was homeless. I went to 91 apartments and properties that have blatant problems in the city. And I reached out to every one of those landlords. And out of those landlords that I reached out to, 43 of them was willing to let homeless people stay in their property as long as they take care of it. Once again, I was turned down by Tony Hart, the mayor. So, once again, I must not stop. There are demands that must be kept to this organization and to this march. That we demand things such as decriminalizing the tickets. You know, If we have porta potties out here, there won't no be body to the bathroom on top of the green. Where's the porta potties at? There's not out here. So what they do, they write tickets. So now we homeless, we can't pay for the tickets. We gotta do community service or go to jail. It's not fair.
Down with tickets.
Now, once again, it's getting cold. So they say you can't be in the park after a certain time. Well, let's not forget, this is not a city park. This is the town green.
That's right.
Once again, when you move us out of places where we feel safe, it becomes risky shelter. And we all know what happens when risky shelter happens. Because of Mr. Ray Robeson, whose family hasn't been healed to this day, whose man leg was found on the train tracks, whose body torso was found in the Salvation Army. And that's called risky shelter. No more risky shelter. Here it is, you have 75 men.
75 men.
Cooped up in one building.
One building.
With two case managers.
Two case managers.
How are we supposed to get housing?
House.
It's bed bug infested.
Yeah. Bed bug infested.
No longer should they have to live the way of that entrapment in that building. So I say, let's knock that building down and build a new shelter.
That was Quentin Staggers, organizer of the November 1st Housing Not Jail March in New Haven, Connecticut. Learn more about homeless activism in Connecticut and across the country by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada, WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.